In the early morning light, Anatoly and I dug a grave, while Seabird and Davern set up the tent. We simply could not go on. Amal was shattered with grief and could not stop sobbing.
"Why her?"
he would say in the moments when he could speak at all.
"She was the best person here. The best person I've ever known. She shouldn't have been the one to die."
I couldn't wash those last few seconds out of my brain. Why had she stopped? How had that brainless, eyeless thing sensed her? Later, Amal became angry at me for having prevented him from saving her.
"Maybe I could have distracted it. It might have taken me instead of her."
I only shook my head. "We would have been burying both of you."
"That would have been better,"
he said. Everyone gathered as we laid what was left of her in the ground, but no one had the heart to say anything over the grave. When we had filled it in, Sally crept forward to sniff at the overturned dirt. Amal said,
"We need to mark it so we can find it again."
So we all fanned out to find rocks to heap in a cairn on the grave. We no longer feared the return of the spiders, or anything else, because the umber life had gone dormant in the sun, our light being as toxic to them as theirs was to us. Everything had retreated into their shells and closed their sliding covers. When we viewed them in our own light, they still blended in with the stones of the crater floor. We ate and snatched some hours of sleep while nothing was threatening us. I was as exhausted as the others, but anxious that we were wasting much daylight. I roused them all before they were ready. "We've got to keep moving," I said. We resumed the work of freeing Bucky where we had left off. When all was ready, we gathered behind him to push.
"Bucky, go," I ordered.
His wheels only spun in the sand.
"Stop," I ordered.
Then, to the others,
"We're going to rock him out. Push when I say go, and stop when I say stop."
When we got a rhythm going, he rocked back and forth three times, then finally climbed out of the trench that had trapped him. Amal helped us reload the buggy, but when it came time to move on, he hung back.
"You go ahead,"
he said.
"I'll catch up with you."
"No way," I said. "We all go, or none of us." He got angry at me again, but I would not let him pick a fight. We let him have some moments alone at the grave to say goodbye. At last, I walked up to him and said,
"Come on, Amal. We've got to keep moving." "What's the point?"
he said.
"The future is gone."
But he followed me back to where the others were waiting. He was right, in one way. Nothing we could achieve now would make up for Edie's loss. How we were going to carry on without her, I could not guess. When we camped, there was no music now, and little conversation. The winding wall was a blue line ahead in the distance, and as we continued, it rose, ever more impassable, blocking our way. We did not reach the spot where the gully path pierced it until we had been walking for 13 hours. We were tired, but resting would waste the last of the precious sunlight. We gathered to make a decision.
"Let's just leave the buggy in the crates and make a run for home,"
Amal said. He looked utterly dispirited. Davern and Seabird turned to Anatoly.
He was the only one of us who was still resolute. "If we do that, we will have wasted our time," he said. "We can't give up now." "That's right," Davern said. Amal looked at me. There was some sense in his suggestion, but also some impracticality. "If we leave the buggy, we'll have to leave the tent," I said. "It's too heavy for us to carry." We had been spreading it as a tarpaulin over the crates when we were on the move. "We knew from the beginning that the wall would be an obstacle," Anatoly said with determination. "We have to make the effort." I think even Amal realized then that he was no longer our leader. We unloaded the buggy, working till we were ready to drop, then ate, and fell asleep on the ground. When we woke, the sun was setting. It seemed too soon. Each crate took two people to carry up the steep path. We decided to do it in stages. Back and forth we shuttled, piling our cargo at a level spot a third of the way up. The path was treacherous in the dark, but at least the work was so strenuous we had no need of cold suits until umber should rise. The life forms around us started waking as soon as dark came. It was the pre-dawn time for them, when they could open their shells and exhale, like someone shedding a cold suit. They were quiescent enough that we were able to avoid them. 15 hours later, our cargo was 3/4 of the way up, and we gathered at the bottom again to set up the tent and rest before trying to get buggy up the path. The X-ray alarm went off while we were asleep, but we were so tired, we just shut it off and went on sleeping. When we rose, an inhuman architecture had surrounded our tent on all sides. The umber life had self-organized into domes and spires that on close inspection turned out to be crawling hives. There was something deformed and abhorrent about them, and we were eager to escape our transformed campsite, until Seabird gave a whimper and pointed upward. 300 meters above, the top of the winding wall was now a battlement of living towers that glowed darkly against the sky. Shapes we couldn't quite make out moved to and fro between the structures, as if patrolling the edge. One fat tower appeared to have a rotating top that emitted a searchlight beam of far ultraviolet light. It scanned back and forth, whether for enemies or for prey. We didn't know. We realized how conspicuous we were in our glowing cold suits. "I'd give up breakfast for a can of black paint," I said.
"Maybe we could cover ourselves with mud," Davern ventured.
"Let's get out of here first," Anatoly said. The feeling that the land was aware of us had become too strong. Getting Bucky up the steep trail was back-breaking work, but whenever we paused to rest, umber life gathered around us. The gully was infested with the plant creatures that had once launched pins at us. They had grown, and their darts were the size of pencils now. We learned to trigger them with a beam from our flashlights. Every step required a constant, enervating vigilance. When we had reached the place where we left the crates and stopped to rest, I announced that I was going to scout the trail ahead. No one else volunteered, so I said, "Amal, come with me. Seabird, hold on to the dog." Amal and I picked our way up the steep trail, shining away small attackers. I saw no indication that the umber life had blocked the path. When we reached the top and emerged onto the plateau, I stood looking around at the transformed landscape. At my side, Amal said,
"Oh my God."
The Damrite Barrens were now a teeming jungle. Everywhere stood towering, misshapen structures, competing to dominate the landscape. An undergrowth of smaller life clogged the spaces in between. Above, in the umberlit sky,
floated monstrous organisms, like glowing jellyfish, trailing tentacles that sparked and sizzled when they touched the ground. 10 or 12 of the lighthouse towers swept their searching beams across the land. There was not a doubt in my mind that this landscape was brutally aware. I spotted some motion out of the corner of my eye, but when I turned to see, nothing was there. I thought, only predators and prey need to move fast.
"Look," Amal said, pointing. "Weird."
It was a ball, perfectly round, and perhaps a yard in diameter, rolling along the ground of its own accord. It disappeared behind a hive mound, and I lost track of it. We had turned to go back down the ravine when one of the searchlight beams swept toward us, and we ducked to conceal ourselves behind a rock. Amal gave an exclamation, and I turned to see that we were surrounded by 4 of the rolling spheres. They seemed to be waiting for us to make a move, so I pointed my flashlight at one. Instantly, it dissolved into a million tiny crawlers that escaped into the undergrowth. The other spheres withdrew. "They're coordinating with the beacons," I hissed at Amal. "Hunting cooperatively."
"This place is evil," he said.
We dashed toward the head of the gully. Too late. I spotted ahead the largest dart thrower plant I had ever seen. The spring-loaded tail triggered, releasing its projectiles. I dove to one side. Amal was not quick enough, and a spine the size of an arrow caught him in the throat. He clutched at it and fell to his knees. Somehow, I managed to drag him forward till we were concealed in the gully. The dart had pierced his neck through and was protruding on the other side. There was no way to give him aid without taking off his cold suit. He was struggling to breathe. I tried to lift his hood, but the dart was pinning it down. So I said, "Brace yourself," and yanked the shaft out. He gave a gurgling cry. When I got his hood off, I saw it was hopeless. The dart had pierced a vein, and his cold suit was filling with dark blood. Still, I ripped at his shirt and tried to bind up the wound until he caught at my hand. His eyes were growing glassy, but his lips moved.
"Leave it,"
he said. He was ready to die. I stayed there, kneeling over him as he stiffened and grew cold. My mind was a blank until suddenly I began to cry. Not just for him, for Edie as well, and for their unborn children, and all the people who would never be gladdened by their presence. I cried for the fact that we had to bury them in this hostile waste where love and comfort would never touch them again. And I cried for the rest of us as well, because the prospect of our reaching home now seemed so dim. When Anatoly and I brought the shovel back to the place where I had left Amal, there was nothing to bury, only an empty cold suit and a handful of teeth were left on the ground. All other trace of him was gone. Anatoly nudged the cold suit with his foot. "Should we bury this?" Macabre as it sounded, I said, "We might need it." So we brought it back to our camp. We let the others think we had buried him. We convened another strategy session. I said, "Amal had it right. We need to make a run for it. To hell with the cargo and the buggy. Leave the tent here. It only draws attention to us. We need to travel fast and light." But Anatoly was still animated by the inspiration of our mission. "We can still succeed," he said. "We're close. We don't need to give up. We just have to outthink this nightmare.
Okay, how?
We bring everything to the head of the gully and build a fort out of the crates. Then we wait till day comes and make a dash for it while the Umberlife is sleeping.
We can only get as far as the Mazy Lakes before night, I said.
We do the same thing over again. Wait out Umber Night. Food's no longer such a problem with two less people.
I saw true faith in Seabird's eyes and calculated self-interest in Davern's. Anatoly was so decisive, they were clearly ready to follow him. Perhaps that was all we needed. Perhaps it would work. All right, I said. Let's get going. We chose a site for our fort in the gully, not far from where Amal had died. When it was done, it was a square enclosure of stacked crates with the tent pitched inside. I felt mildly optimistic that it would work. We slept inside it before bringing Bucky up. Then we waited. There were sounds outside. Sally's warning growls made us worry that something was surrounding us to make an attack, so we set four of our lanterns on the walls to repel intruders, even though it used up precious battery life. Hours of uneasiness later, dawn came. We instantly broke down the fort and found that the lamps had done their job, since there was a bare circle all around us. We congratulated ourselves on having found a way to survive. The daylight hours were a mad dash across the dam right. We had to clear the way ahead of Bucky, and we took out our anger on the hibernating Umberlife, leaving a trail of smashed shells and toppled towers. We reached the edge of the lakes at sunset and instantly saw that our plan would not work. Around the edges of the wetland stood a dense forest of the tallest spires we had yet seen, easily dominating any fort walls we could build. There would be no hope of staying hidden here. At the edge of the lake, the blooming abundance of horrors stopped, as if water were as toxic to them as light.
If only we had a boat, Anatoly exclaimed.
But the life around us did not produce anything so durable as wood. Even the shells were friable. The light was fading fast. Soon this crowded neighborhood would become animate. Ahead, a narrow causeway between two lakes looked invitingly empty. If only we could make it to a campsite far enough from shore, we could build our fort and wait out the night.
Let me get out my maps and check our route first, I said.
Darren gave an exclamation of impatience, but Anatoly just said,
Hurry up.
We were on the side of the Mazy Lakes, where my maps were less complete. On the outward journey, we had cut across the ice, but now, after 40 hours of daylight, that was not an option. I was certain of only one route, and it seemed to take off from shore about 5 miles away. I showed it to the others. Davern still wanted to follow the route ahead of us.
We can just go far enough to camp and come back next day, he argued. We've already been walking 12 hours.
No, we're not going to make any stupid mistakes, I said.
Anatoly hesitated, then said,
It's only 5 miles. We can do that.
But 5 miles later, it was completely dark, and almost impossible to tell the true path from a dozen false ones that took off into the swamp whenever I shone my lamp westward. I began to think perhaps Davern had been right after all, but rather than risk demoralizing everyone, I chose a path and confidently declared it the right one. It was a low and swampy route, ankle deep in water at times. I went out ahead with a tent pole to test the footing and scout the way. The sound of Davern complaining came from behind. As soon as we came to a relatively dry spot, we set up the tent
intending to continue searching for a fort site after a short rest. But when we rose, Bucky had sunk 6 inches into the mud, and we had to unload half the crates before we could push him out. By the time we set out again, we were covered with mud and water. "Now we can try Davern's plan of covering our cold suits with mud," I said.
"We don't have much choice," Davern muttered.
Umber rose before we found a place to stop. Then we discovered that the lakes were not lifeless at all. By umber light, the stromatolites fluoresced with orange and black stripes. In spots, the water glowed carmine and azure, lit from underneath. We came to a good camping spot by a place where the lake bubbled and steam rose in clouds. But when the wind shifted and blew the steam our way, we nearly choked on the ammonia fumes. We staggered on, dizzy and nauseous. The fort, I realized, was a solution to yesterday's problem. Staying put was not a good idea here, where we could be gassed in our sleep. We needed to be ready to move at a moment's notice. Geysers of glowing, sulfur-scented spray erupted on either side of our path. We headed for a hummock that looked like a dry spot, but found it covered by a stomach-turning layer of worm-like organisms. We were forced to march through them, slippery and wriggling underfoot. As we crushed them, they made a sound at a pitch we couldn't hear. We sensed it as an itchy vibration that made us tense and short-tempered. But Sally was tormented till Seabird tied a strip of cloth over the cold suit around her ears, making her look like an old woman in a scarf. I didn't say so, but I was completely lost, and had been for some time. It was deep night, and the water was freezing by now, but I didn't trust ice that glowed, so I stayed on the dwindling switchback path. We were staggeringly weary by the time we reached the end of the road, on the tip of a peninsula surrounded by water. We had taken a wrong turn. We stood staring out into the dark. It was several minutes before I could bring myself to say, "We have to go back." Seabird broke down in tears, and Davern erupted like a geyser.
"You were supposed to be the great guide and tracker, and all you've done is lead us to a dead end. You're totally useless."
Somehow, Anatoly summoned the energy to keep us from falling on each other's throats.
"Maybe there's another solution."
He shone his light out onto the lake. The other shore was clearly visible.
"See? There's an ice path across. The whole lake isn't infested. Where it's black, the water's frozen solid."
"That could be just an island," I said.
"Tell you what, I'll go ahead to test the ice and investigate. You follow only if it's safe."
I could tell he was going to try it, no matter what I said, so I made him tie a long rope around his waist and anchored it to Bucky.
"If you fall through, we'll pull you out," I said.
He stepped out onto the ice, testing it first with a tent pole. The weakest spot of lake ice is generally near shore, so I expected it to crack there if it was going to. But he got past the danger zone and kept going. From far out on the ice, he flashed his light back to us.
"The ice is holding," he called. "Give me more rope."
But there wasn't any more rope.
"Hold on,"
I called, then untied the tether from Bucky and wrapped it around my waist. Taking a tent pole, I edged out onto the ice where he had already crossed it. It was about 30 meters out onto the lake when he called.
"I made it! Wait there!"
He untied his end of the rope to explore the other side. I could not see if he had secured it to anything in case I fell through, so I waited as motionlessly as I could. Before long, he returned.
"I'm coming back,"
he yelled. I was a few steps from shore when the rope pulled taut, yanking me off my feet. I scrambled up, but the rope had gone limp.
"Anatoly!"
I screamed. Seabird and Davern shone their lights out onto the ice, but Anatoly was nowhere to be seen. I pulled in the rope, but it came back with only a frayed end.
"Stay here,"
I said to the others, then edged gingerly onto the ice. If he was in the water, there was a short window of time to save him. But as I drew closer to the middle, the lake under me lit up with mesmerizing colors. They emanated from an open pool of water that churned and burped. The lake under the black ice had not been lacking in life. It had just been hungry. When I came back to where the others were waiting, I shook my head, and Seabird broke into hysterical sobs. Davern sat down with his head in his hands. I felt strangely numb, frozen as the land around us. At last I said, "Come on. We've got to go back." Davern looked at me angrily.
"Who elected you leader?"
"The fact that I'm the only one who can save your sorry ass," I said. Without Anatoly's animating force, they were a pitiful sight, demoralized, desperate, and way too young. Whatever their worth as individuals, I felt a strong compulsion to avenge Anatoly's death by getting them back alive. In this land, survival was defiance. I ordered Bucky to reverse direction and head back up the path we had come by. Seabird and Davern didn't argue. They just followed. We had been retracing our steps for half an hour when I noticed a branching path I hadn't seen on the way out.
"Bucky, stop," I ordered.
"Wait here," I told the others. Only Sally disobeyed me and followed. The track headed uphill onto a ridge between lakes. It had a strangely familiar look. When I saw Sally smelling at a piece of discarded trash, I recognized the site of our campsite on the way out. I stood in silence, as if at a graveyard. Here, Amal had played his violin, and Anatoly had imagined songs of Umber Night. Edie had made Sally's cold suit. If we had just gone back instead of trying to cross the ice, we would have found our way. I returned to fetch my companions. When Seabird saw the place, memories overwhelmed her, and she couldn't stop crying. Davern and I set up the tent and heater as best we could, and all of us went inside.
"It's not fair,"
Seabird kept saying between sobs.
"Anatoly was trying to save us. He didn't do anything to deserve to die. None of them did."
"Right now," I told her, "your job isn't to make sense of it. Your job is to survive." Inwardly, I seethed at all those who had led us to expect the world to make sense. We were 10 hours away from the edge of the lakes, 30 hours of walking from home. Much as I hated to continue on through Umber Night, I wanted to be able to make a dash for safety when day came. Even after sleeping, Seabird and Davern were still tired and wanted to stay. I went out and shut off the heater, then started dismantling the tent to force them out. The lakes glowed like a lava field on either side of us. From time to time, billows of glowing, corrosive steam enveloped us, and we had to hold our breaths till the wind shifted. But at least I was sure of our path now. The other shore of the Mazy Lakes, when we reached it, was not lined with the towers and spires we had left on the other side, but when we pointed our lights ahead, we could see things scattering for cover. I was about to suggest that we camp and wait for a day, when I felt a low pulse of vibration underfoot. It came again, rhythmic like footsteps of a faraway giant. The lake organisms suddenly lost their luminescence. When I shone my light on the water, the dark surface shivered with each vibration. Behind us, out over the lake, the horizon glowed. "I think we ought to run for it," I said. The others took off for shore, with Sally on their heels. "Bucky, follow," I ordered, and sprinted after them. The organisms on shore had closed up tight in their shells. When I reached the sloping bank, I turned back to look. Over the lake, visible against the glowing sky, was a churning, coal-black cloud spreading toward us. I turned to flee. "Head uphill," I shouted at Davern when I caught up with him. Seabird was ahead of us. I could see her headlamp bobbing as she ran. I called her name so we wouldn't get separated, then shoved Davern ahead of me up the steep slope. We had reached a high bank when the cloud came ashore, a toxic tsunami engulfing the low spots. Bucky had fallen behind, and I watched as he disappeared under the wave of blackness. Then the chemical smell hit, and for a while I couldn't breathe or see. By the time I could draw a lungful of air down my burning throat, the sludgy wave was already receding below us. Blinking away tears, I saw Bucky emerge again from underneath, all of his metalwork polished bright and clean. The tent that had been stretched over the crates was in shreds, but the crates themselves looked intact. Beside me, Davern was on his knees, coughing. "Are you okay?" I asked. He shook his head, croaking, "I'm going to be sick." I looked around for Seabird. Her light wasn't visible anymore. "Seabird!" I yelled, desperate at the thought that we had lost her. To my immense relief, I heard her voice calling. "We're here," I replied, and flashed my light. Sounds of someone approaching came through the darkness, but it was only Sally. "Where is she, Sally? Go find her," I said, but the dog didn't understand. I swept my light over the landscape, and finally spotted Seabird stumbling toward us without any light. She must have broken hers in the flight. I set out toward her, trying to light her way. The umber life around us was waking again. Half-seen things moved just outside the radius of my light. Ahead, one of the creature balls Amal and I had seen on the other side was rolling across the ground, growing as it moved. It was heading toward Seabird. "Seabird, watch out!" I yelled. She saw the danger and started running, slowed by the dark. I shone my light on the ball, but I was too far away to have an effect. The ball speeded up, huge now. It overtook her and dissolved into a wriggling, scrabbling, ravenous mass. She screamed as it covered her, a sound of sheer terror that rose into a higher pitch of pain, then cut off. The mound churned, quivered repulsively, grew smaller, lost its shape. By the time I reached the spot, all that was left was her cold suit and some bits of bone. I rolled some rocks on top of it by way of burial. Davern was staring and trembling when I got back to him. He had seen the whole thing, but didn't say a word. He stuck close to me as I led the way back to Buggy. We're going to light every lamp we've got and wait here for a day, I said. He helped me set up the lights in a ring, squandering our last batteries. We sat in the buggy's umber shadow and waited for dawn with Sally at our feet. We didn't say much. I knew he couldn't stand me, and I had only contempt for him. But we still huddled close together. To my surprise, Bucky was still operable when the dawn light revived his batteries. He followed as we set off up the Let's Go Valley, once such a pleasant land, now disfigured with warts of umber life on its lovely face. We wasted no time on anything but putting the miles behind us. The sun had just set when we saw the wholesome glow of Feynman Habitat's yard light ahead. We pounded on the door, then waited. When the door cracked open, Devern pushed past me to get inside first. They welcomed him with incredulous joy, until they saw that he and I were alone. Then the joy turned to shock and grief. There. That is what happened. But of course, that's not what everyone wants to know. They want to know why it happened. They want an explanation. What we did wrong. How we could have succeeded. That was what the governing committee was after when they called me in later. As I answered their questions, I began to see the narrative taking shape in their minds. At last, Anselm said, "Clearly, there was no one fatal mistake. There was just a pattern of behavior. Naive, optimistic, impractical. They were simply too young and too confident." I realized that I myself had helped create this easy explanation, and my remorse nearly choked me. I stood up, and they all looked at me, expecting me to speak. But at first, I couldn't say a word. Then slowly, I started. Yes. They were all those things. Naive. Impractical. Young. My voice failed, and I had to concentrate on controlling it. That's why we needed them. Without their crazy commitment, we would have conceded defeat. We would have given up and spent the winter hunkered down in our cave, gnawing our old grudges, never venturing or striving for anything beyond our reach. Nothing would move forward. We needed them. And now they're gone. Later, I heard that the young people of Feynman took inspiration from what I said and started retelling the story as one of doomed heroism. Young people like their heroes doomed. Myself, I can't call it anything but failure. It's not because people blame me. I haven't had to justify myself to anyone but this voice in my head, always questioning, always nagging me. I can't convince it. Everyone fails. If I blame anyone, it's our ancestors, the original settlers. We thought their message to us was that we could always conquer irrationality if we just stuck to science and reason. Oh, yes. The settlers. When we finally opened the crates to find out what they had sent us, it turned out that the payload was books. Not data. Paper books. Antique ones. Art. Philosophy, literature. The books had weathered the interstellar trip remarkably well. Some were lovingly inscribed by the settlers to their unknown descendants. Anatoly would have been pleased to know that the people who sent these books were not really rationalists. They worried about our aspirational well-being. But the message came too late. Anatoly is dead. I sit on my bed, stroking Sally's head. What do you think, girl? Should I open the book from my great-grandmother?